Accession number 19671, Reel 5.
Harry McLaren, Reel 5.
Yeah, so I thought it had some connection with his wife being an opera singer. And thought on about it when I heard... I realised now they wouldn't have laid all that on just for movie being an opera singer.
But you evidently thought you were going to be paraded on stage in front of
him. Oh, yes, right. That was quite probable because that's the way it was done. I remember the German paper, the book, which was Bayerbach, about that time they had a picture on the front page of an American airman. And he was wearing his jacket, and on the back of his jacket he'd painted Murder Incorporated. It's terrible moves. Murder. But the odd thing was, the Luftwaffe themselves they still got this sort of rapport between airmen. They knew the score. Harris said, they sowed the wind, they're going to reap the whirlwind. And they did.
You're saying that in the Canadian Squadron, each of the bombers was called after a film star.
No, not exactly. There were several named after film stars. Merle Oberon, I've flown with. Rochester, and the comedian. Rita Hayworth, I think. Greer Garson. Actually, on the night we were shot down, we were flying Judy Garland. Now, the reason for that was that after we were shot down, we had to bail out and we lost our machine. That was Piccadilly Princess, it was called. Now, Billy, our pilot, called it that. And we had a picture on the front of some lady of the night. But in actual fact, I found out since that Billy's family had a yacht called Piccadilly Princess, and that was named the same. Well, that was our machine we flew. Now, after that, we had anything that came along, because it wasn't worth moving near the end. In fact, the day we were shot down, I should have mentioned this, the adjutant asked us what we wanted to do when we were screened. That's the term when you've done your whack, the 30. What happened? A pilot had gone out the night before in this machine, a chap called Caldwell, and he turned back, said he couldn't get airspeed. So being a senior crew, we were asked if we would take this machine the next night. So Billy said, yes, you see. Well, when we got out to the plane to join it that night, it was obvious what was wrong straight away. Do you know what the pitot head is? It's where the speed goes in. Well, it's a pipe, L-shaped, you see. And it's covered with a canvas covered during the day so the wind doesn't go through it and work the speedometer. Well, you've got to take that off, obviously, when you fly. Now, it's the usual thing. It's pitched so high you can't reach it, and there's no such thing as a ladder. So what you do, somebody gets on somebody else's shoulder, and they snatch at it. Well, of course, what happened in this case, you snatched at it and bent it. So what we did, we got up and bent it back. So off we went. But, of course, if we'd have got home that night, we could have reported what was wrong with it. But having got the chop, they might have thought all kinds of things, But that plane was named after Judy Garland.
What are these pigeons in planes for?
Well, if you come down in the sea, you can, there's a container on it, you can write to be a position on it. I believe that if you're not able to do that, but just let the pigeon go, they can get some idea of how long it's flown properly or something. That's better than nothing, put it that way. That's the idea of it. It has worked in a few cases.
Was anybody in charge of the pigeons?
Oh, pigeon loft, yeah, yes.
Anybody in the air crew?
No. No, because what they do, if you come down the sea, you see, you've got to get out. Now, there's various, there's toggles. There isn't a Wellington, you can pull toggles that cause the air bottle that's with the dinghy to blow up and blow it out. It's housed in the back of the engine in the nacelle, and it's attached to a rope. And the theory is, by the time you've the plane settled and you got out either through the Astrodome or the top of the pilot's canopy or even out through the turret, wherever you get out, even out the back, you think he's floating on a rope there. Here you are, so jump in. And there's a pack of food, which is about 2 foot long by 18 inches deep, about 4 inches wide, with all kinds of things, tins of water and that in. And that's got a rope, so you're supposed to be able to throw that and it floats, you see. And you've got the rope. When you get in the dinghy, you're set then for a while. You've got the dinghy radio to thing out, and the pigeons if you want to, if you can do. I don't know how you can write on wet paper, but anyway, it has worked. I mean, so it was all done for a good thing.
You said that when they knew that Flying Fortresses were going to fly with the bomber stream, that there were groans.
Yeah.
What was the reason?
Too bloody true. Well, they fire any damn thing, weren't they? It didn't come off, actually. And, I mean, my memory's been pretty good, really. Where it's been checkable, it's okay, and I've had arguments with people. But this actually did come off about 5 days later. Is it Eker, the American chief of the Air Force, he wanted to get in some effort. And that was the idea of flying as gunships. But you see, the Germans had a selection of captured aircraft. I'll give you another instance. We bombed Le Creusot in the south of France one night, bright moonlight night. And on the way back over France, another aircraft tried to formate on us. And we wouldn't have it. We kept moving away and he kept moving in. And it turned out that there was another plane in our squadron, but he was to the moon side of us, so we only had the shadow. The moon was, he could see our identification letters, you see, in the moonlight. And he wanted to formate and fly along it, but we wouldn't take the risk. We couldn't see.
Yes, that red on the cruiser.
Yeah, 4,000 feet.
19th of something.
Renault Works, it was. And here I am driving.
Probably 19th of June.
What does it say down there?
Yes, 19th of June, 1943. Before we finish, any brief memories of POW experience?
Well, no. I was only 19, but I wouldn't have missed it. Now, that seems a funny thing to say. We had no food. We didn't get anything like the Geneva Convention should have said. You're supposed to have the same food as the base troops. But we had this skilly. I realise now that I could have got repatriated, but I didn't hear of it at the time. And I would have taken it if I'd been offered, of course, but... But that period in my life, I don't regret. I had a hell of a job to settle down after the war. And the only thing I can think of, it was the comradeship, because we were at rock bottom. I mean, you got any kind of lunatic with a rifle, and the Germans, you know, didn't hesitate to shoot. But we were the second batch to go to 4B. 4B had soldiers there from Crete in 1941, and then they'd gone. There was only French and Belgians and Dutch, and they used to push them around a bit, but they had little numbers, you know, they settled in. Because the first batch of 78 aircrew went there in end of August. Now, we were the second batch. Now, they had it a bit rough, and so did we. We were kept in the huts all day and allowed out for half an hour or an hour in the afternoon. Well, just before I got there, I was in the French for about a week after I got there. The Germans had a Serbian used to come and massage my back, so I was in this French place. So they were kicking a ball around, and this ball went between two huts towards the road that goes round in the centre of the camp. I can show you on a map in a minute. So in other words, it wasn't going towards the fence, it was coming deeper in the camp. One of the lads ran down to get it without, you know, as you would in the course. And the German standing on guard up with his rifle to shoot him. Of course, he was knocked on the ground, his rifle was taken off him and was thrown down in a bloody bog. The huts had a night latrine with them, all like an open cesspit they brought down there. Not very nice either. And of course, there was a hell of a hoo-ha over that, but what it was an indignity shown towards the German army, you see. The commandant of the camp was a man with no legs. He was in the First World War in an Alpine troop, Colonel Stossier. He was all right. In fact, I've seen him stop and give a cigarette to a Russian who had no legs, who used to go around on a bit of a platform. But we got moved into an RAF compound then. They kept the RAF separate because what happened, just as we sort of let the Germans know that we were the British and we couldn't be pushed around like the others, the Italians, who had already chucked it, the prisoners that the Germans took from the Italians were brought up to our camp. Instead of being about 120 British airmen, it was only 30,000 British soldiers, you see, with 8 or 9 regimental sergeant majors, all very conscious of their seniority. And so they got an idea with the Germans then, roughly the idea, you guard the outside of the camp and we'll run the inside of the camp. And of course life was a lot better for the other nationalities as well, because we had complete freedom all day walking around in the camps. Yeah, we weren't allowed to go up to the wire, there was a trip wire, but it was okay. Well, also we were entitled to have a walk around the lanes once a month or something. So they carried this out in the early months. Now, I put in for a job. I thought I could do some therapy, and oddly enough, they wanted volunteers to work in the camp library and post office, but I got put in the cookhouse, which is better for me, physical activity. And I came back from work in the kitchen one day, and I slept on a bottom bunk, and next to me was a English soldier who was a paratrooper from the early paratrooper, a Scotsman, Doc Kerr. Very, very nice man, one of these quiet Scots. And when I sat there on my bunk, he was sobbing. So I said to him, whatever's the matter, Doc? I thought the post has come in while I've been out, just saying he's got a bad letter. He said, well, he said, I'm sorry about this. I just can't help myself. He said, I went out for a walk this afternoon, one of these organised walks. It's a walk along the road, and a lady came and walked alongside the chap in front of me and was chatting to him in English. He said it reminded me of my mother, and I can't stop myself. But it turns out that this lady who walked there was an English lady married to a German officer, and the man she was talking to was her son by a first marriage. So you've got the situation of a woman with a son in the Air Force and her husband. I think he was a colonel in the German army and another. Well, she came to see him quite frequently. The Germans allowed this to happen. And at the end, I think she got him one of the huts and came home with her son. That was made into a book and a film, which was an absolute distortion of the truth.
But what damage had you done to your spine?
Ah, well, no, this was it. Of course, I recovered quite a bit. I couldn't sit long without getting pain and that kind of thing. But eventually, the anti-neuralgia pills were taken off me the next day when I left the German aerodrome. And the sticking plaster waistcoat fell off after about 6 weeks. And that was the only treatment I got, but I used to walk around and do exercises. But it happens that when I got demobbed, I was equipment officer in an RAF hospital, a place called Wolseby in Lincolnshire. And when you went for your demob medical, you didn't just give a sample in a jar to a corporal, there's a bloody squadron leader there. So he examined my chest, and I got rather prominent veins on the chest, which one of my colleagues in the camp who being a medical student, said, well, it was due to when you hurt your back. He pointed, he said, if you strain yourself one part of the body, it's obviously going to come out. Anyway, this officer said, well, I got them when I hurt my back. Immediately interested, what do you mean hurt your back? I said, well, when I did a parachute jump, I landed in a tree. Well, he had me on the x-ray table before I could look round, and they, in all, they took 12 different shots at different angles, and of course I really had the bloody wind up. So he called me in the end, and he said, well, you've fractured your fourth lumbar vertebrae, and it's cracked right through. He showed the white line on it. He said, but what I can say, you've been very, very lucky, it's healed up. And he said, if you had a splinter of bone gone in your spinal cord, you would have been paralyzed from your waist down. So he said, but you've told me yourself, you worked in the cookhouse, you know, throwing bags of spuds around and that kind of thing. And so he said, you've been very, very fortunate.
Did you make a full recovery?
Oh, yeah.
You said that you had difficulty in readjusting to civilian life.
Yes.
In what sense?
Well, I joined the police force. And of course, that was very Victorian in those days. But I mean, you think of it, like, before I was 20, I'd had the bow hit of two planes that were crashing or they couldn't fly. I was a prisoner of war. You know, all kinds of Germans, as I say, they weren't reticent about using their rifles. There was the, 24 raids. I mean, that's equivalent to a soldier going over the top 24 times, isn't it? And some of these raids were 9 hours long. Constant danger. You know, what kind of excitement is there for a lad? Now, when I was a country policeman, you know, I nearly fall off my bike if a plane went over, looking at it. And in those days, there are only old Hansons and things like that. But, I had a hell of a job to settle for. In fact, I claim with some degree of truth that it's still in my blood.
You mean it was because you were bored with civilian life?
No, when I worked in the shipyard, I was far from bored. I loved it.
I mean after the war?
No. It was a different kettle of fish. You see, they asked aircrew to any that signed on would only drop one rank. And I said, yeah, and the first time you're going to get any blotto, they get AC plonk. But now I know a few that did that. They kept faith with it. But you see, the pensions in those days were negligible. I mean, flight sergeant. I was a warrant officer at the end of the war. We were called before the adjutant after the 10th of October with a view to getting commissions. The rest of the crew, the pilot was given an immediate commission, and the rest of the crew were told to put in papers for a commission. But the bomb aimer and myself were the two youngest of the crew, and he said, come back in 3 months. 6 weeks later, we were prisoners of war. And the only survivor, of the others got their ranks posthumously, except the engineer who survived. He came out of prison camp as a flight lieutenant. We came out, the bomb aimer and myself, as warrant officers. But the big thing in the RAF was, but certainly on the Canadian squadrons, they think of a damn for your rank, that's what you've done. I've been walking down the flights one day with a Canadian. The adjutant's gone by on his bike. I chucked him up a salute, and this Canadian said, "Hiya, Chaz, you old bastard." He said, "Where'd you get through last night?" Christ, imagine saying that on an English squadron. And you know, it was very free and easy. I didn't think of a damn for discipline. That must have affected me in some way or other. And of course, the police force, you had to humbly beg to report all the time. It was a bit dull, but you got your excitement elsewhere, of course. But there was quite a long settling down period.
Oh. Did you ever go back to Germany too?
Oh, yes. I on the 45th anniversary of being shot down, I was reintroduced to the Gunter family in a place called Obertraubing near Tutzing. That was the lady, the daughter that rendered me the first aid. It came about because another colleague shot down on the raid. He was investigating this, and he, in the course of investigating his own career, he'd been introduced to a German historian, amateur historian, and this historian had recorded the raids on Munich and had seen the Gunther family, and they gave a statement in which they said they'd like to meet me again, told him my name, which I'd obviously left with them, and she recorded to this story that I spoke perfect German. But of course, I think there was a bit of romance about that, because I could only just about get by. But anyway, we went back there, and consequently, on the 50th anniversary, we arranged for the survivors to go back, and I went into a great deal of time and trouble trying to find the survivors. It wasn't successful with all of them, and most of them were dead, but Ray Edgehill was one, and Hugh Moore was another. Phil Jenkinson and myself, we went back, but this came on to the reason why we went back to Munich, and Hans Grimminger, this German historian, very nice chap by the way, he frankly disbelieved that this had happened. And of course in the end he was forced to believe it, because we all, when asked about it, said it was the opera house we went back to. I don't know what the reticence was to accept this, but of course then they do accept that we did go back there. But it seems that nothing like that was ever done before. An odd person like a fighter pilot was probably befriended by the man who shot him down and taken around, a bit of a sightseeing, but there's nothing organised like us. And there's been many questions as to why it happened at all, but my view is, as I believe I've said, that the Germans were trying to probe to find out how much we knew about their rockets. But there's a great sense now, I personally feel very humble when I think back. We tried to trace the boy Richard that spoke to me through the window, but it seems that he was evacuee from Augsburg and they'd lost trace of him during the war. But the Germans are very friendly, they all want to buy your beer. Of course, I'm talking about Bavaria, by the way, and the Bavarians are like the Yorkshire men here, they consider themselves Bavarian before German. And they think the world of my wife, and they're very interested in it all. Makes you wonder why it ever happened, really, because they're humble people, have no control over this. So my only regret, as I've said, is that the children who suffered. I mean, I knew what I was doing, quite openly. I put my neck on the line. I was fortunate to survive. Unfortunately, colleagues didn't.